Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And so today we are actually picking up on an issue that we touched on briefly a few months ago in a Q&A episode, but it's been kind of rumbling along and growing in interest, and we thought it really warranted a full-length episode discussion, and that is the new brand of anti-obesity drugs, which have been exploding in popularity and in use and raising a whole bunch of very interesting questions. I don't know if you saw this, Dad, but there was a lot of commentary around the Oscars last week or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, people talking about how it was an unusually sleek looking year. And in fact, the comedian Jimmy Kimmel, who was hosting, had this line, which I quite enjoyed. When I look across the room, I can't help but wonder, is Ozempic right for me? and that's the brand name of one of the drugs that's been particularly popular in America. To quickly explain for those, we'll get into the science in a minute, but there is a new category in the last few years of drugs you can take injections once a week, known as Ozempic, is one of the most common ones. The drug itself is called semaglutide, and these help suppress appetite and cravings and have seen remarkable effects in weight loss. But before we should launch into that, I guess we should really explain why this is such an interesting question, which is the kind of explosion of obesity and overweightness in the last few generations.
So I'm reliably informed, not knowing that first-hand experience, that this has become incredibly trendy among celebs.
Yes, it is.
And is the sort of thing that influencers discuss, you know, how I lost 20 kilos and this is how you can get these the drugs and get hold of them.
Because there's a flourishing kind of almost black market, because they're so demand so far outstrip supply, it's generally quite hard to get hold of them. And so obviously the super rich elites in LA have got their tame doctors who might, you know, cheekily prescribe them, even though it's supposed to be for diabetes, to give them this drug and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of that about, you know, who's your Wegovy man, you know, where are you getting your Ozempic from? And it's really kind of become embedded in part of the culture there, surprisingly quickly.
So it's a kind of perfect storm, isn't it? You know, so sleek, slim, you know, this has always been highly desirable amongst in the internet era. And it's one of the modifiers you can put on your image, can't you? You can have these AI images which distort you and make you look much slicker and slimmer. But now you don't need to use an AI. You know, you can do it for real, you know, because we've got the technical fix.
Yeah. And it's amusing and kind of eye-rolling to think about these, you know, tortured celebrities desperately trying to squeeze into a dress one size smaller than last year. But I think the real story and the real reason why the world is paying so much attention to these drugs is because obesity is actually genuinely not just something that the ultra rich worry about. It's now affecting people who are overweight and obese amount to 38% of the world's population. And that was actually in 2020. So I'm sure that rate has gone up in the preceding 4 years. That amounts to an astonishing 3 billion people worldwide.
I mean, it is just worth just stopping and pausing on that, isn't it? Because I think back to my time as a student when there was this extreme concern and horror about the population death of the planet, of overpopulation. And a lot of it was going to be related to starvation, the Malthusian, you know, concepts that of all the starving billions across the world, we were going to see food riots, we were going to see tragedy coming unless we did very major reductions of population. And here we are 50 years later, and over 30% of the world's populations are struggling with obesity.
Yeah,
it's mind-boggling, and it's over 1 billion apparently who are clinically obese. In other words, they have a BMI of greater than 30, which is very significant. 1 billion people across the planet.
Yeah.
So, in fact, well, of course, food scarcity is still present, but it's largely in places of terrible political unrest and warfare.
That's right. And the kind of spread of what began in the West in the 20th century, this kind of sometimes called industrialized agriculture, the kind of transformation of the food industry into a kind of industrial machine, and food production moves away from just simply, you know, growing things in the ground as we always have done, to it being quite a kind of scientific, business, capitalist oriented thing. Is as that has spread around the world, obesity has very much kind of followed in its wake. And so it begins in the West, but then you can see very clearly as places like China and India in particular have kind of had seen enormous growths in their middle classes over the last 50 years, enormous rises in wealth. And along with that, tragically, as they've adopted a kind of Western diet and Western style industrial agriculture, they've seen similar explosive rises in obesity.
That's right. And then, you know, for me as a doctor, thinking back to my years as a paediatrician, you know, the standard medical mantra, which I'm sure you've heard as well, that doctors have recited for decades, is that the solution to obesity is to eat less and to exercise more. It's as simple as that. And yeah. I remember sitting in the clinic in my hospital, having been referred children with excessive weight, and speaking to their parents, and that was the mantra which was the received wisdom of medics, that you've got to get him to him or her to eat less and to exercise more. And yet I know very well that that mantra by and large is extraordinarily ineffective, that despite the fact that doctors and dietitians have gone on about this endlessly, we also know it's very ineffective. It rarely works.
Yeah. I think, you know, growing up, I, even as late as, you know, 1990s and the 2000s, I was still kind of imbibed this sometimes unspoken, sometimes explicit message that, you know, weight gain and weight loss is relatively simple. You know, you simply need to burn more calories than you consume and you'll lose weight. And if you consume more calories than you burn, you will gain weight. And therefore, the corollary of that is that people who are overweight are so because they lack self-restraint, because they don't know when to stop eating, or because they can't, they're eating more calories than they're exercising is burning away. And it's seen as fundamentally something about self-control. And yet I feel like actually in the last kind of 10 to 15 years in my adult life, people have swung away from that. And part of that is a kind of cultural thing, the kind of, you know, fattest, you know, this idea that actually being fat is an identity, and therefore it's a protected identity and it shouldn't be kind of discriminated against. But also I think more seriously, because it's so obvious that the rise in obesity is so clearly tied to changes in how we produce food and how we live as a modern industrialized society, that it's hard to deny that, you know, it can't simply be that, you know, for thousands of years 5% of human beings were obese, and then suddenly in the last 50 years human beings got much, much less self-disciplined, and that's why 40% of human beings are overweight. It seems it's been kind of tested to destruction, and people are casting around for more complicated explanations.
Absolutely. And so the classic explanation, scientific explanation for this is an evolutionary one. And that is that, you know, if we go back to our faithful friends, the hunter-gatherers on the African savanna, with these almost mythical creatures, the theory goes that in general, they lived in a calorie scarce environment, but every so often they came across, for instance, a carcass of an animal, or a hive with honey, and then the logical thing to do, obviously, is to try and build up your calorie scores as much as possible, in order to then survive the periods of scarcity. And therefore, the people who tended to survive were genetically facilitated towards this kind of behavior. And interestingly, it's been said that in the natural environment of a hunter-gatherer, it's very rare to come across the combination of fat and sweet and salt. Those three things are all reward signals, but in nature, you don't get foods in general which combine them. They're pretty scarce. Whereas what was discovered is that if you combine those two, if you have something that is both sweet and fatty and salty, like salty caramel ice cream, lo and behold, this suddenly activates the reward signals in a very powerful way.
Yeah, people often talk about this idea of it kind of hacking your brain. The brain, our brains are so overwhelmed by how incredibly delicious and desirable these kind of foods are that we end up binging on them, like we are a kind of hunter-gatherer stumbling across the carcass of a saber-toothed tiger, and we don't know if we're going to eat for the next 3 weeks. So it actually makes sense to eat as much as your stomach can literally stand before you vomit. Whereas obviously now, in an era where there's a supermarket on every corner, it doesn't make sense to binge on an entire tub of ice cream, but we can't help ourselves. And this has kind of led to further research, as I understand, looking at what is it going on in our brains that makes us want to eat or not eat certain foods, and understanding it's actually a lot to do with hormones in your blood, and then also particular receptors in your brains about how sensitive they are to those hormones.
That's right. So this has been an area of research going on for decades, but it is, and it takes a long time. You have a lot of basic science research involving laboratory experiments, experimental animals with studies with rats and so on, which eventually lead to a better understanding of the role of molecules. And then that leads on to drugs in the human. And this is called translational research. It's sort of translating science out of the laboratory and into, sometimes called bench to bedside, that's the goal of this research. But this is a classic example. So research in animals increasingly showed this important peptide. Sorry, I'm going to cough. Research in animals increasingly showed the importance of this a peptide, a short segment, a chemical signaler within the brain called GLP-1. And this is a naturally occurring hormone which operates on receptors, and there are multiple sites inside the brain which with receptors for this particular hormone. And what it does is it reduces the reward signal of food. It seems, that kind of feeling you have when you've really had a big meal and you're just, oof, I couldn't touch another mouthful.
Can't even think about food. Can't even look at food. You're I'm so sure that's full.
Never occurred to you, Tim, but it occurs to me.
Occasionally, and maybe after my third helping of Christmas dinner, once or twice, I might have said, you know what? I might give it a few hours.
Exactly. And so the theory is that what's happening is your brain is flooded with this peptide, which is saying, stop, stop, stop. And it makes the whole thought of food very unattractive. I just can't think about it. I just don't want to go there. And the theory is that this peptide is being released from the bowel, which is passing in the bloodstream and acting on receptors in the brain. And this is just part of the normal homeostatic control mechanisms. But the theory goes is that in people who are genetically predisposed to obesity, these receptors are down-regulated. They're not, so that when the hormone is being released, but it has much less action. So people carry on eating with this longing to eat more and more, despite the fact that this peptide is being released.
And this kind of explains how it's been shown in plenty of studies that you know, you can give two people an identical diet to the calorie and they will have very different outcomes in terms of how much weight they put on. It kind of explodes the idea that it's simply about, you know, calories in and calories out. But it's that, and it's not just about willpower, but actually, you know, the same food can affect a different gut and a different brain in quite different ways. And some people will eat food and say, you know, this produces this kind of fat in me. And some people, it will do others. And even more so, some people will not be able to stop eating, whereas another person, through no greater virtue of their own, will just feel fuller and be like, I don't really want a second bite of that, which we kind of know instinctively true. We can all think of people, you know, there's irritating people in our lives who just don't struggle to stop eating after one portion and never want another slice of cake for some reason I can't fully wrap my head around. But clearly they just have highly sensitive GLP-1 receptors in their brains.
That's right. And so therefore we also know that there's a close connection between eating, appetite, and emotion, and how we feel about ourselves. And certainly for some people, you know, it's a common experience that if they feel depressed or anxious, there's just a tendency to eat in order to satisfy those feelings. You know, and we joke about someone having a chocolate cuddle, but it's that it shows the close connection between these receptors in the brain. So you can imagine that what's happening in those situations is that the anxiety, the depression is actually turning down the receptors, and therefore you need more GLP. That's a craving for food increases in association with depression.
And so once the scientists had figured out this really critical hormone and the receptor combination and the effect it has on eating, they then actually initially through diabetes research figured out that they could create artificial versions that mimicked the effect of GLP-1. So basically you'd give these drugs, which ended up to become called semaglutides, and they would kind of trick the brain into thinking, all right, my gut is full and it's releasing this hormone. I therefore need to turn down my kind of desire to eat. And that is the fundamental process why they work, is that when you take these drugs, it basically makes you feel full, makes you feel like, oh, I couldn't face the idea of eating anymore, more before you've actually binged loads of food. And so you don't lose weight through any magic. You lose weight because you're just not eating as much food. But people suddenly, the way it works is that it doesn't require any additional willpower, because your body is swimming in this hormone that's telling your brain, stop eating, you're full, before you've actually managed to quaff that fourth slice of cake.
That's right. And so what people say, you know, that going back to those celebs, you know, whereas previously they had to master these continuous cravings for food because they knew they couldn't eat, they would lose their sleek shape. And so you just went through every day suppressing these cravings for food. Now they discover actually it's not a big deal. Yeah. And so I don't need willpower. The cravings have gone.
And there's this fascinating piece I read in, I think it was Variety or The Hollywood Reporter, about this, where they interviewed all these people in the kind of ancillary Hollywood world, like personal trainers, but even high-end restaurants, who were saying, it's rubbish because we're losing money, because the rich celebs would come in and before, you know, they would order everything off the menu at hundreds of dollars, and now they just have a small salad and they're like, no, I'm fine, thanks. Genuinely, you know, there was like these restaurateurs saying like, you know, our business model relies on basically rich people coming in and overeating on this food, but now they can literally just sit there while their friends who aren't on a Zempic gorge away, and they're just like, I just genuinely don't want any of that food. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's just a salad leaf will be absolutely fine.
Just don't worry about me, I'll just nibble on a celery stick while you chow on your T-bone steak or whatever. But this is why it feels like magic, right? Because if you're someone who's been trying to lose weight for years, I imagine you've gone through endless kind of restricted calorie diets and different versions of that, but they all rely on you being able to constantly every day say no, I could eat more, but I'm going to choose to not. And then suddenly you'd have this injection, and for the next week, you don't have to make the decision. The decision has been made for you. It's easy. And the weight therefore just falls away.
Yeah, but it's important not to over-focus on the celebs, because the reason why this is so important from a health point of view is that real obesity, including, you know, what's called morbid obesity, where people are just absolutely hugely obese, is associated with catastrophic health problems. You know, it's very well known that the vast long list of health problems that morbid obesity causes, and including a massively reduced lifespan, all the problems of heart and diabetes and joint problems, and on it goes, liver problems and so on. And what is already being demonstrated is that by giving these drugs, you get a very significant reduction in the health complications. And this is where it starts to become economic. Just if you take the strict health economics, the lifetime costs of obesity in terms of health-related complications are enormous.
Yeah.
And so it could become economically justified, certainly in cases of morbid obesity, which is the route that is happening here in the UK. Because of the NHS, there's a very tight control on the use of these drugs, and they're being targeted at people with the greatest health problems.
Yeah, and there's a recent kind of, I mean, we should emphasize these drugs are incredibly new. They've only really been on the market for a matter of years. So there's a lot of uncertainty about the long-term consequences, but there are now studies starting to come through. There was one in August of 17,000 people who had excess weight and cardiovascular disease. And the people who were on semaglutide had a 20% lower risk of heart attacks and strokes than those who were on a placebos. And there are other studies that have shown similar improvements on things that being on the drug can delay kidney disease progression in diabetes patients. It can improve, double your heart improvement. It can. So these are not just, as you say, we should not get focused on the kind of aesthetics of, you know, it's good to lose weight, but actually obesity is a real public health crisis. And these drugs have genuinely been very promising in terms of tackling some of the associated health risks of being overweight.
Yeah. And what's fascinating is that it feels almost like a perfect storm is brewing up. And it's particularly within the USA, because the figures in the USA are even more startling. So currently, more than 40% of Americans are classified as obese. And it's estimated that that's going to rise to nearly 50% by 2030. So if 50% of your population are obese, and you've now got a drug which is expensive, but which is potentially applicable to half the population. You can see the problems coming.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And this this drug is not cheap, you know. It can be as much as $1,000 a month. Some reports say $15,000 a year for a treatment of one person. And when it's, you know, a tiny number of people who are, you know, diabetic or whatever, but if we're seriously saying actually there is a urgent public health crisis and this is our best weapon, are we really going to be able to afford to put 50% of the entire country on a $1,000 a month drug regime, or are we going to actually going to only be able to restrict it to those who are like seriously kind of clinically morbidly obese?
And of course, this then relates to the economics of the pharmacological industry.
Hmm.
So it doesn't really cost them $1,000 a month to manufacture this drug. And in fact, it's perfectly possible. If you look at the real manufacturing cost of the drug, it's of a handful of dollars a month. So how do they justify charging $1,000 a month? And the reason they justify it is that it's that commercial profit which pays for all the R&D that they've already spent billions of pounds on R&D researching this drug, and also that it pays for future research, that we're going to be finding new and better drugs in this class, and that's going to cost us a lot of money. And so the reason we charge so much money is in order to get the money to pay for the R&D. And there's an additional wrinkle here, and that is that the big pharma companies have the highest costs in the USA. So when they're selling their drugs to Europeans, they know that Europeans are stingy and they're not going to pay. And they've got these state systems, and the state systems bargain down lower prices. But where you've got a free market in drugs, which is what you've got in the USA, you charge what the market will stand. And so Americans pay the most for their drugs compared to anywhere else in the world.
Hmm. And this drug is making two companies in particular staggeringly wealthy. So there's two firms that are out in the front here, which is a Danish company called Novo Nordisk, and then American pharma giant Eli Lilly, who are producing two very similar versions of this semaglutide. Novo Nordisk, in just 2 years ago, was selling $876 million of Wegovy. 1 year later, that had jumped to $4.5 billion in just 1 year. And the company expects it to double again in 2024. And so Novo Nordisk has now tripled its market capitalization and is now Europe's most valuable company. In fact, it's so valuable that when the statisticians in Denmark do their annual GDP figures, they have to exclude Novo Nordisk, even though it is kind of chartered in Denmark. Because if you include it, it makes Denmark's economy look like it's growing at like 20%, which it obviously isn't, because Novo Nordisk is now worth more money than the rest of the Danish economy combined. And then Eli Lilly has doubled its value itself in 2023. So these two companies are basically almost kind of taking over the pharmacological industry because of the insatiable demand for this drug, which they, they're building factories, opening factories every few months to produce more of it, and they still can't come close to meeting demand.
And interestingly, although their other manufacturers are struggling to compete and to develop their own drugs, and there's no fundamental reason why they can't. The chemical structures are all very well known. They're in the public domain and so on. What happens is that there are patents which protect for a number of years, which protect these companies. And so in order to for other companies to produce their own drugs, they've got to do something which is slightly different, not exactly the same molecule, but has the same effect. But they've then got to go through all the testing regime. They've got to go through clinical trials, demonstrate, the phase one, phase two, phase three trials, and demonstrate safety and efficacy before they get approval from the regulatory authorities. And that means that these companies with their established drugs are just way out in front. And as you say, there's an almost insatiable desire for this drug. So I think there's going to be similar kind of battles over this as there were, for instance, over the vaccines. Is it right that these incredibly rich and wealthy Western companies should hold the rest of the world to ransom, quotes, with these massively inflated prices? And what happens if some other countries like India start producing low-cost copies of this drug. And you know, one can see huge battles going on in the future.
And this comes down to kind of longer-running conversations people have long had about the kind of structure of the pharmaceutical industry, which, as you say, the kind of standard argument is, you know, these private companies take all the risk of the R&D, and therefore they're allowed to effectively kind of capitalize by exploiting for the duration of their patent by overcharging, and then it will go generic and the prices will drop after a certain period of exclusivity, which, you know, is a model and has worked relatively well over the last kind of 50 to 60, 70 years. But there are lots of people who would say, actually, there are different ways we could produce pharmaceuticals with maybe greater kind of social costs. You know, people have talked about creating kind of publicly owned and funded pharmaceutical research companies where, you know, the R&D is done up front by the state and then is shared evenly across the population. Because you have that, you know, if you are Novo Nordisk and you only have, so you cannot sell your drug to everyone who wants it, you then have to choose, do I sell it to the UK NHS, who will drive an incredibly hard bargain because they are run on behalf of the taxpayer, or do I sell it to in the US, where I could charge three or four times the price, but the NHS are going to give it to people who have diabetes and who are dangerously clinically obese, and in the US those doctors will sell it to LA celebrities. Now, obviously, I'm massively simplifying. That's not really how it works, but you can see how it's actually sensible for Novo Nordisk, which exists solely to maximize shareholder value, to actually sell the drug to people who maybe don't need it quite as badly.
Yeah, but and you can see all the problems with this commercial model. But I think it's really important to recognize that this commercial model has led to staggering improvements in healthcare over the last 50 years, because, you know, the majority, certainly a very significant percentage of all the significant breakthroughs in drug, you know, which have really transformed people's lives, have depended on this commercial model. Although you can say in theory, we know, why don't we have state-run pharmaceutical industries? They have not been a successful model in terms of taking the risks, the entrepreneurial drive to do research and then market and so on. So I think, you know, as a medic who's spent so much time using commercially produced medication and seeing the life transformative effects, you know, it's the capitalist system. The capitalist system has very deep rooted problems within it, and yet is remarkably powerful and effective.
I mean, you could say this is capitalism responding to pressures caused by other aspects of capitalism. And it's how capitalism can be quite destructive, and yet also contains within it its power to try and kind of self-correct. You know, the reason we have an obesity crisis is in part because of capitalism and the way that, you know, food production has become taken over by profit-seeking companies trying to make us buy as much of this unhealthy junk food as possible. And then that caused an obesity crisis, which then prompted capitalist pharmaceutical companies to invest billions in R&D to find a drug to solve that problem. And on it goes. New problems get caused, and then the system tries to create solutions to, and all being driven by this incredibly simple but powerful profit motive. It's kind of remarkable when you step back from it. Whatever your thoughts on the morality of it, is a remarkable system that we've created.
Well, this is Adam Smith, and there is a power in the market mechanism. But I think what we have learnt painfully over centuries of capitalism is that it needs regulation, it needs control. That if you leave the market system just to spin away without any kind of regulation, it very rapidly leads to terrible injustice and evil. And I suspect that this is as I said, a kind of perfect storm, which is going to lead inevitably to some whole rethinking about commercial incentives, I think. I mean, it's possible that the market will sort itself out, that there will, what will happen is there'll be a flood of GLP-1 agonists. So they're working, for instance, on getting oral tablets, which do the same. I suspect they'll be able to crack that. That will make these much more available, but it will therefore drive expenses down quite rapidly. But it could be, given that you've got a problem which is affecting literally billions of people, you can see, I can see real conflict coming and concern in the future.
One of the other angles on this we haven't touched on really, which really fascinates me, is how this whole kind of shift in how we think about obesity, which has been massively expedited by the rise of these drugs, and it is changing our understanding of obesity from a kind of personal failure, from a lack of self-discipline, a failure in self-restraint, to a purely medical condition. You know, it's simply a biological factor. It's about blood sugars and drugs and hormones in our gut system and our brains and neuroendocrine, whatever. And this is often, there's often a pushback when you talk about this. There's often people, let's face it, mostly thin people, react quite badly to the idea that actually we should be treating obese people just simply as the same way we would treat people who had cancer, you know, victims who need medical treatment, rather than people who have failed. Because I think thin people basically cannot deal with the idea that, or don't like the idea that they are thin by luck, because they happen to be born with hypersensitive GLP-1 reward centers, receptors in their brains, rather than because they're virtuous good people who have made good decisions day after day after day.
So you think that thin people are more judgmental, basically. Actually, you know, this is really interesting, because I've had a sudden flashback. Historically, there was this, they categorized people in body shapes into two forms. There was the endomorph and the ectomorph. And the endomorph is long and thin. And there's a kind of caricature that they tend to be sort of miserable and unpleasant. And then there's the ectomorph. And the ectomorph is sort of globular in shape. And they're happy, jolly people who enjoy life. Yeah. And I'm just wondering whether this is the modern equivalent.
Yeah, very possibly.
You're describing the endomorphic personality.
But I think it's interesting because it is a genuine, quite a big cultural shift to move away from the idea that fat people have done something wrong, that they have failed in some way. And ultimately, because food has been associated with morality, with virtue, for thousands of years. I mean, gluttony was one of the seven deadly sins. You know, this is a long-standing idea, and not just in Christian thinking, but in lots of other thinking, that how what you ate, how you ate, and what you looked like was not just like something like the hair color, but it was actually reflected something about who you were as a person.
Yeah, before we came on air, we were just reflecting about this in the biblical narrative, and we were reminding ourselves about the fact that, you know, in that very important passage when the people of Israel are wandering in the desert, that one of the themes that comes around is that these disobedient children of Israel, the rebellious children of Israel, were fantasizing about the flesh pots of Egypt.
And they were craving, sick of this manna that God was giving them.
You know, God had provided all they needed, but they were sick of it. And so there's a very strong biblical association then, isn't it, with craving as a form of idolatry. It's it's putting my bodily needs as at the center, and it's refusing. And whereas fasting, abstinence, is a godly way of controlling appetites.
Yeah, there's this strong idea about, I mean, self-control is obviously one of the fruits of the Spirit, and you see this repeated theme in all the New Testaments, often combining it with overeating and with drunkenness as examples of how, of sins where people have kind of indulged and lost their self-control, and whether that's eating too much rich meat or drinking too much wine, this is it runs throughout. There's lots of kind of condemnations of this. And at the same time, you have that tradition which says, kind of ascetic monastic tradition, which says, you know, controlling yourself, beating your body into submission, being an athlete, training yourself, in all that language that Paul uses, that is super spiritual. That's what the best of us do. You know, people who take these vows of poverty and abstinence, and that involves not just refusing the kind of pleasures of the world, but one of those pleasures might be good food as well. And living in a monastery and subsisting on kind of bread and cheese for years upon years is seen as kind of highly virtuous, super Christian. And so it wouldn't surprise me, actually, if Christians are among those who react most negatively to suggestions that we should just whack everyone who's overweight on this drug and solve the problem that way.
So along comes the neuroscientist and he says, you know, how quaintly primitive, you know, that now we understand that all these cravings are due to reward activation centers and we understand the receptors. And this is the way forward. The way forward is to modulate the brain centers. And I think this is just one example of what I see as a growing trend in neuropharmacology, and that is drugs that are intended to make us more virtuous, you know, drugs that will suppress evil, not just food cravings, but drugs that will suppress violent impulses, drugs that will make us more pro-social, more compassionate, more caring. You know, this is the modern approach to morality. So what's your response?
Well, I think it's a massive challenge, isn't it? Because the Christian view has long been that human beings, going back to the Garden of Eden narrative, we chose to rebel against God. We chose to sin. We chose to embrace a life turned in ourselves, a life of idolatry, and we turned away from God. This was a free choice that God, in his wisdom and mercy, let us walk away from him. And that is why we are worthy subjects of wrath. You know, we deserve the punishment that's coming our way if we weren't forgiven by Jesus. And so there is a conversation to be had about, does our modern understanding of how cravings and desires work, whether it's food or, as you say, violent cravings, drinking too much, sleeping around, if we can reduce all of that to complex interplay of hormones and brain receptors, does it take an axe to this Christian view that actually we're fundamentally people with free will who need to take personal responsibility for our moral choices? Possibly. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right that the concept of free will, of freedom, that we are not just puppets programmed, responding to whatever influences, the concept of free will is an absolutely central Christian understanding of what it means to be human. And it's interesting, if you take a very long view of over human history, it seems like this concept of freedom has been under continual attack. So you go back to the sort of pre-scientific era, and it was the fates, or it was the planets, or astrology. These were what were controlling us. And then you take a very extreme version of hyper-Calvinism that says it's just God's sovereignty that is determining everything. We have no genuine freedom. Or then you take Marxism that says, no, we're economically determined. Or Freud, who says, no, we're psychologically determined. Or the geneticist who says, no, we're genetically determined. And now, lo and behold, it's the neuroscientist who says, no, you're all wrong. It's all to do with receptors in the brain. And I think against all of those kinds of determinism, historic Christianity says, no, these things are real. We don't deny the fact that all these things influence our behavior, but ultimately our humanity depends on our ability to choose and therefore to be accountable for our choices. But our choices are influenced and distorted often by these very powerful forces.
It's not actually necessarily that new idea, though maybe the language is different, because we've long had this train of thought in Christianity about abiding sins, you know, people that might be certain, because of the way they are kind of more drawn or tempted towards certain sins over other sins. And that's certainly something we should take heed of, you know, we should be aware of it, we should shape our discipleship around that. But it doesn't mean that if you do end up falling into one of your abiding sins, you're any kind of less morally culpable for it in God's sight, or he gives you any credit in the bank for saying, well, you know, Tim did do X, Y, and Z, but he does always struggle with that more than most people, so that doesn't quite matter as much. But it does mean actually that we should take into account the fact that we're not all kind of tabula rasa blank slates for whom all of the different temptations of the world act on equally.
Yeah, and of course there's a very famous and rather contested passage in the Romans which reflects this. I often think come back to that, and that's in Romans chapter 7, where Paul says, I delight in the law of God in my inner being, but I see in my members, or my organs, another law waging war against the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? He then goes on to say, thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. But there is, you know, even Paul himself is describing this phenomenon when we find ourselves doing something and I'm thinking, I don't really want to do this, and yet I find myself doing it. So this internal conflict is part of the human condition, and it isn't play acting. We are not puppets. I'm reminded, of course, it's really important to point out to the materialists that if you don't believe in free will, you are suddenly locked into a real problem, because your very beliefs about there not being free will is determined. You remember that years ago there was this public campaign that Richard Dawkins and others had the side of bus that said, there's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy yourself. And I saw a very clever riposte to that, which was a bus which was going along, and it's along the side it says, there's probably no such thing as free will, so stop worrying, brackets, as though you had any choice anyway. And that's the point, isn't it? Yeah. If there's no free will, if we're not free to choose what we believe, then even our beliefs about free will are themselves programmed. So freedom is actually an essential part of what it means to be human.
Mm. But do you think maybe there is a space to integrate into kind of Christian theology about personhood and moral responsibility, this idea that some people might have a diminished responsibility for doing things? You know, if we are able to identify that in the brains of certain people, you know, I mean, let's look at gluttony. That was a sin, at least according to kind of Christian tradition. You know, are we possible to say, do you know what, this person is guilty of the sin of gluttony, but now we understand that is in large part because of their brain chemistry, and so we're going to cut them a bit more slack than we might for another person who was actually just being greedy? Can we integrate this idea of we're not going to go totally down the line of it's all determined and we have no choice, but could we find a halfway house between that and the other extreme?
Yeah, I think so. I'm reminded of a passage where C.S. Lewis reflects about this, and he says, you know, you look at someone who's living a very virtuous life, and then you look at another Christian who seems to be struggling with all kinds of obvious sins. And then he says, don't judge. You don't know how easy it is for the one person to live virtuously and how much the other person. It could be that the other person who seems to be living a life of obvious brokenness actually is struggling much more to follow Christ than you can ever be, know how much. So this fundamental idea that we mustn't judge other people because we don't know what's going on inside, I think that is right. And what modern science does is it just gives a kind of mechanistic explanation for why certain sins are attractive to certain people. And we're all fallen, we're all broken, but some of us are tempted in some directions, some of us are tempted in others. And what the Christian ethics constantly reminds us is it's the hidden sin of pride, which is often much more of a stench in God's eyes than the obvious sins of the flesh.
But I wonder whether that is difficult, particularly for certain kinds of evangelical Christians to come to terms with, because there was a strong sense in the kind of tradition I grew up in, church circles we moved in, that, you know, we have quite a black and white approach to sin. You know, a sin is a sin, and the Bible, Jesus says it's no different if you have a bad thought in your head about someone as if you had murdered them with your bare hands. It's all the same. We don't have a kind of hierarchy of sins. They all deserve the punishment of death. And it's quite an all or nothing approach. And introducing these kind of shades of grey and this idea of like differing levels of responsibility and abiding temptations would seek to kind of cut against this very like clinical black and white, everything is obvious, these are sins, these are not sins, do these, don't do these.
I think you're right, and I think there is a lot of that very simplistic black and white, often reductionist understanding of sin, and And it so easily lapses into a kind of Pharisaism, doesn't it? You know, because basically, look, you know, it's the Pharisees who were keeping
herbs.
they were keeping the laws. And it's striking how often it's Jesus reserves his criticism for the Pharisees, not for the prostitutes and the tax collectors. So I think there is a rather simplistic black and white understanding of sin, which is simply doesn't fit with the reality. But I don't think it's there in Scripture either. I think it's a much more nuanced understanding of the fact that. Not that sin is not just personal, it's structural, isn't it? So there is evil in the structures of society. And we just talked about the pharmacology industry. We talked about the commercial pressures on producing foods and so on. This is part of structural evil. And therefore developing a kind of nuanced understanding that in a fallen universe, evil contaminates every aspect of our humanity. And yet, while retaining the confidence that ultimately the Christian faith says that, but for both personal evil and structural evil, the power of Christ is greater than the power of evil, and that ultimately it goes back to when we talked about redemption, that evil can be turned and redeemed and turned into good.
And I often think about how we can get sidetracked trying to figure out if a certain thing is a sin or a certain thing is not a sin. You know, we talked about this in other issues about IVF and that kind of stuff, and we get obsessed with these kind of trying to nail down everything in clean black and white sense. And actually there's this big idea in Scripture that actually sin is about is a life turned away from God, is a life in rebelling God. And it can be, of course, individual acts, but it's also about the posture of your heart over many years. And that is something that's less easy to nail down and write down in a doctrinal statement, perhaps, or but actually that's something that maybe our discipleship is better focused on, is not necessarily obsessing about rooting out and trying to categorize and define every act as sinful or non-sinful, but actually thinking about what would a life turned towards God, what would a life lived in joyful obedience and faithfulness look like, and stepping forward in that positive framework rather than simply trying to tread through the minefield, not to step on any of these actions in case that's a sin and it blows up in your face.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so coming back, maybe just closing on these astonishing advances in human understanding our humanity, understanding the struggles, I think it leads to a deeper compassion, I think. That's my response. You know, understanding the forces which all of us are prone to, not wishing to be judgmental for others who will struggle in different ways, and yet longing to bring health and healing in all its aspects. And therefore, yes, at a spiritual level, we want to help people to understand their own accountability for their actions. They're not puppets. They're not unresponsible, but at the same time recognizing the physical and the psychological and the relational elements, which gives us that holistic understanding.
And in closing then, if a Christian who is overweight is listening to this and wondering if they should go and try and get prescription for some Ozempic, would you say go for it, or would you say, Hank, think about it a bit more?
Well, there's overweight and overweight, isn't there? So I would say, if there's someone who is struggling with morbid obesity, which means very significant obesity that is causing major health problems, then yes, I think they should certainly seek medical advice and medical treatment. There are a number of other options. These drugs are not the only one, but there are. It's definitely worth looking at. One of the things we haven't mentioned, but I just perhaps before we finish, and that is, nobody really knows about the future of these drugs. The worry is that if you take it for a year or two, you lose vast amounts of weight. What happens when you stop? If you've still got the same genetic predisposition, are you going to get back to square one? And therefore, are you going to have to take this for the rest of your life? And secondly, what are the side effects? You know, as with any new drug, once you start giving a drug to large numbers, undoubtedly we're going to start seeing side effects. acute pancreatitis has been already recognized. No doubt there are going to be other problems. So there are no powerful drugs like these which don't have significant side effects. There's always going to be balancing benefits and risks. But nonetheless, so far, it does appear that the benefits substantially outweigh the risks. And for those whose health is being severely affected, it does seem this is a way forward.
Yes, we'll have to keep an eye on this, how it unfolds. It's incredibly kind of cutting edge pharmacological development. So we'll have to see over the next few years as we have a bigger kind of corpus of evidence about what effect this is having on individuals, but also, as we talked about, on kind of culture and society at large. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope that was an interesting conversation to listen along to. We'd love to know your own thoughts. If anyone out there has tried semaglutides in various types, please do write in. We'd love to hear how you've experienced it, what your thought process was around that. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. And there's also, as always, lots of resources and interesting things to read and listen to and watch on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. But otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.